As is often the place, I didn't get the memo, I guess. We're going to go ahead and begin with a hearing on public hearing on House Bill 2784. And we'll open that hearing. I want to welcome Representative Mabry and Commissioner Luke from Deschutes County. We're glad to see you again. You were so patient, as you pointed out when I came in the room today. You were so patient yesterday, waiting until we took care of all these representatives, that this time to jump to the front of the agenda, you went out and hired one of your own to come with you on your bill.
Well, it was worth it. It was worth the wait to have Representative Johnson say that I was one of her friends. So that was.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Please, Representative, begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was important to me that I bring Commissioner Luke with me, because I was afraid if you asked me a question, I wouldn't be able to answer it. And I'm really here to let Commissioner Luke give you the details of the bill. I came personally because I wanted you to know that it wasn't just a courtesy in putting my name on a bill to get it here. It's something I really, truly believe in. But as far as having taken the time to ferret out the details, I didn't do that. So if I may, I will defer to Commissioner Luke.
Did you want staff to give me background first? Or you
Go ahead, Commissioner. He'll help pass the stuff out, and I'm sure you can summarize it pretty quickly for us.
Okay, I want to thank the committee for hearing the bill today. Deschutes County Board of Commissioners are the governing body of the Black Youth Service District, and so that's my capacity here today. For the record, it's Dennis Luke, Deschutes County Commissioner from Bend, Oregon. Former Senator Neil Bryant and Senator Ron Cease, Representative Lee Byer, and myself appeared before the OMA in Sun River after the 95 session. And Senator Bryant did a little presentation and said that sometimes you pass bills not knowing the unintended consequences of those bills, and that he had done that himself. And Senator Cease, not letting that go by, said, "We noticed that a lot about you, Senator." We bring you this bill today, not as a fix for unintended consequences of previous bills, but an effort to clarify legislative intent of the 95 and 97 bills, two bills, one in 97 and one in 95. Possible problems with the authority of the Black Butte Service District to provide police services was discovered as we were finishing up the Sun River Service District, which happened just this last year. There were some questions raised, and research by our legal counsel, Rick Isham, pointed out that there might have been a problem with the Black Butte Service District providing police services. So as not to take any chances, the sheriff went down and swore all those deputies back in as sheriff's deputies until we could figure out which way we wanted to fix this. There are three possible courses of action. One is to leave things alone. If there's a challenge in court, our legal counsel, Rick Isham, believes that we can show that legislative intent intended for Black Butte and another district up in Clackamas County to be able to provide these services. We can have a reformation election for the Black Butte Service District, which is expensive for the constituents there, or we can pass this bill to establish the previous legislative intent. And, of course, we would hope that we could pass this bill to do that. In conversations with Neil Bryant, he told me that the 1995 and 97 bills were aimed at one Black Butte, and there was another special district up in Clackamas County that was affected. To best of our knowledge, this bill would only affect those two districts. And we ask you for your support on passing this bill forward. This bill is also supported by the Deschutes County Sheriff Les Stiles, the Black Butte Chief of Police Gilbert Nicaro, the Black Butte Homeowners Association, the Deschutes County Board of Commissioners, former Senator Neil Bryant, and the Special Districts Association. And Special Districts just came on. They were on board before, but they had to get approval, so they're not in the letter. But Special Districts also asked this bill go forward.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for the commissioner?
Well, the technical language is in the formal one. That came from our attorney. So.
Okay. Yes, counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, I remember this bill, and it was the intent at that time to include Black Butte Ranch, and it's really a very technical issue in which they've got hung up on. I mean, what it is that at the time they were created, the enhanced services were provided by the sheriff. They came in for the purpose of having their own police services, but the language and the technicality did not quite get there.
Right. So the concern is that they were non-sworn officers for some period of time. Isn't that right?
Well,
and that's why
the concern was they may not have had the authority to be sworn officers.
Right. Okay.
They go through the same training process. Their chief is, they're all certified.
Right. They do the DPSST approach and everything else. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. Commissioner, you were talking about the area in Clackamas County and being from that neck of the woods. I'm familiar with the urban enhanced urban program that we have in Clackamas County for Sheriff's Patrol around Clackamas Town Center and the Sunnyside area, which is basically an urban development that doesn't have a police force because it's not inside any city. Is that the area that you're referring to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I don't know.
Okay.
I was just told that this bill affected at that time only two districts. Potentially, I mean, the one in Clackamas may not have went ahead and formed. These are in effect small districts that aren't incorporated cities that are allowed to go ahead and put their police forces together. And I don't know what kind of those are available in your area.
Okay. I would just hope that we're going to make it legal because they do have a levy that supports. Supports the enhanced sheriff's patrols in the urbanized area of Clackamas County. So
I don't believe if the sheriff is providing it, I don't believe there's a problem. This is
it's a special
district.
Isn't a planned community kind of a thing? Because I think that's more of the situation that we had in the Black Butte situation.
Is special district.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Anderson?
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to say that I'm basically in favor of the bill, but I'm wondering about your tie, whether you're trying to lobby us or whether you're just bearing up under this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this is in favor of the bear and cougar.
I thought so.
Bill.
Great timing.
Oh, maybe not. maybe not. And with that kind of humor, Representative Anderson, you're going to earn yourself a seat on the Revenue Committee. Okay. Any further questions? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2784. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2784.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, I move that we...
he had raised his hand.
Yeah. Discussion later. I move that we move House Bill 2784 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2784 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, hearing none, let's call the roll. Jane.
Or Nancy, I'm sorry.
Ashley.
Aye.
Edson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen. Crummell.
Aye.
McPherson.
Excused.
Zlonsky.
Aye.
Chatterley.
Aye.
Sherwood.
Aye. House Bill 2784 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anybody who wants to carry it?
Sure, I'll do it.
You want to carry it, Gordon?
Oh. John?
Oh, John? John? You want to carry the bill?
Sure, I'll be happy.
Okay. We don't usually do that, but for to add a great consideration for you, we'll assign it to you to carry on the floor. Yeah, okay. All right. Representative Mabry. Okay. We'll go back up to the top of the agenda and open a hearing on House Bill 2725. Council.
Good bill, do pass.
That's my law.
Modifies crime of giving false information to police officers to include services of warrants and comes to us from Representative Przanski and Representative Barker.
You going to suit up there too, Jeff? Or okay. Representative Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. House Bill 2725 is a bill that will make a fix to a current statute regarding giving false information to a police officer to include when an officer is in the process of serving a warrant. This is an issue for law enforcement many, many times. where they are in the process of actually issuing, or not issuing, but actually carrying out a task of issuing a warrant or serving the warrant, where individuals will in fact try to mislead the officer at that time. And we believe that if the person knowingly gives a false name or fictitious name, date of birth, or address to an officer during that process, they should be held accountable for that that lie.
Are there questions for the representative? Representative Anderson.
The penalty remains the same. It's just adding the two. Continues to be a Class A.
Yeah, the penalty stays the same. All we're doing is including what is currently prohibited by law is giving a false information when an officer is citing the person with the citation or arresting the individual. This would actually would require a person to or stand accountable for a false name when a warrant is being served upon them.
Yes, Representative Parker.
And just to make it clear, if somebody comes out, if an officer asks somebody their name and they lie to them, that's not a crime. It's not until they're going to arrest them and they continue to give them false name that makes the difference.
Anybody else?
I believe you have a couple others.
We've got some other witnesses that we'll bring up. Representative Brzezinski, does this have a fiscal on it? Have we seen a fiscal on this?
I have not seen one. I would assume that there may be would be some type of fiscal on it because you are looking at potentially having additional individuals that would be going through the system. I would say that the fiscal should be, I mean, it's going to be as a Class A misdemeanor as compared to a felony, and so that will be, some of the cost is going to be at the local levels.
Okay. Why don't you want to stay at the desk, Representative, and we'll bring up Brad Berry and Kelly Skye. Brad, is this the first chance we've had to see you all session?
Mr. Chair, I think it is. I was here before the session started to talk about our legislative agenda, and I have not been here. Actually, this week, I've testified. This is my second time this week, and I think I have more on the calendar over the next couple of weeks. So suddenly the time has come.
Well, we're glad to have you here. We understand you've been quite busy out in Yamhill County doing your job.
So. Thank you.
So welcome. Please
Thank
begin.
You. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Oregon District Attorneys Association reviewed House Bill 2725, and we are in favor of it. As Representative Brzezinski said, it is certainly not uncommon that individuals who are approached about the service of a warrant will lie about their identity to avoid being taken in custody on those warrants. I just might note, in addition, that it seems to me to add this particular provision to false information seems kind of intellectually honest with the overall scheme that we have for individuals who deceive officers. A person stopped for a speeding ticket and lies about who they are faces a potential additional penalty for false information to a police officer. If you come to my home looking for someone who I'm hiding for the service of a warrant and I deceive the officer about that, I would be in trouble. And all this really does is add to that some compelling reason for the offender to be candid about who they are and not send the officers on a wild goose chase for the purposes of service of the warrant. And so I think in the overall scheme, it's appropriate one. And secondly, I guess the overall hope would be it would encourage offenders to be truthful about who they are when approached by the officers.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and have Kelly testify, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose this bill because we believe that it will have some constitutional implications. And there are a number of factual scenarios for which this bill would apply, one being what we think of the officer actually having an arrest warrant for a person's name in their hand. They go to the person's house. They say, I have a warrant for Max Williams' arrest. Are you Max Williams? Certainly in that situation.
I don't know how many times I've heard those words.
Certainly in that situation, if you were to give a false name, you'd be guilty of this offense. All the way at the other end of the spectrum is a citizen having a conversation with a police officer for something that has nothing to do with the commission or the commission of a crime or the service of a warrant. Say perhaps there is a traffic accident, a car hits a little girl, and the person who's standing on the street corner happens to witness it and stays because they want to tell the officer that they saw the car speeding and it was the car's fault. But the officer then asks their name and goes to write it down, and they, for whatever reason, be it because they have a warrant or because they just don't want to be placed on that corner at that particular time, they give a false name. The question then becomes, can they, if it turns out later that they discover the person's given a false name, can they be prosecuted for having given a false name because there was a warrant out for their arrest? And that could be a question for the jury, or it could be a question with constitutional implications that would be dealt with pretrial. The reason for that is that your average citizen walking down the street has no legal requirement to give their true name. Currently, the only time that they're required to give a true name is when they are being, for purposes of being issued a citation. And there are two provisions. There's one in the criminal code, as is here, and there's one in the traffic code that covers traffic offenses. And those provisions make sense because in those situations, the person's not being taken into custody. So the only way to verify their identity, or there is no way to verify their identity. You're being stopped, you're being issued a citation for jaywalking, say. You give a false name, you don't show up in court, that citation is never going to catch up with you. And if you gave a real person's name, the real person is then going to have that tacked onto their record, and it's going to become a problem for that person. Current law does not cover people who are being arrested on outstanding warrants or who are being arrested for a crime. If you're being arrested for, say, disorderly conduct and you know you're being arrested and you give a false name, that's not illegal. They'll take you down to the station, they'll do your prints, and they'll determine that you are a different person. But it's not furnishing false information. The situation that we are concerned about in this circumstance is that police officers routinely, when they're out on the street, approach citizens and ask them their name and go back to their car and run them for warrants. They have no legal authority to ask for their name. They are allowed to do it, just as any other citizen is allowed to do it. An officer can approach any individual and ask them any question that any other citizen could. The law is very clear. Constitutionally, the officer cannot detain that person and cannot or hold their ID to go check them for warrants. So our concern is that if officers are going out and they're asking people, what's your name, the person is not now legally required to give a true name. And what this bill, I believe, seeks to do is to make it illegal to give a false name only if you have a warrant out for your arrest and not if you don't have a warrant out for your arrest. So there are two implications. One is officers are going to be detaining people trying to determine whether they have warrants out there for their arrest, which is a violation of an innocent person's constitutional rights. But for the person who actually has a warrant out for their arrest, they may not even know that they have a warrant out for their arrest. They may not be giving a false name for purpose of that. And they may not know that the officer is asking it for purposes of serving a warrant. So there are all kinds of legal issues here. And this statute is not clear on whether the officer has to approach the person and say, I'm looking to serve a warrant, what is your name? Or if they just ask, what is your name? They happen to have a warrant out for their arrest. Are they guilty? We believe that this statute would result in a great amount of litigation over the issues that I've discussed. Not to mention the fact that I do believe that it would have, I wouldn't say a significant fiscal, but it's a new crime that is going to capture people who are not processed in the criminal justice system right now. People who are arrested on outstanding warrants will go, they will sit in jail, they will serve their time. Now they will be arraigned in court, they will be appointed a court-appointed attorney, they will be set for trial on a new offense. So it will be capturing people into the system that were not going to be picked up previously.
Okay. Thanks, Kelly. Let me ask a question, Brad, and Representative Brzezinski, either one of you can answer. Was it your intent when you were using the language in the bill for issuance of service of a citation, which seems pretty clear, or a warrant, if the warrant, were you intending to have that apply to a situation where someone has a known warrant, they're approaching the individual with the intent, believing that that individual to be the person referenced in the warrant and asking them their name for purposes of serving the warrant, or were you intending the bill to sort of capture the situation referenced by Ms. Skye about a general approach to an individual on the street for just running, then just doing the wants and warrants broadly in sort of a bigger sweep kind of an approach? And if it was the first and there was language we could add that would address her concerns, then I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about that. Neither one of you can lead off.
Mr. Chair, I'll just start off. I mean, the intent from my perspective was knowingly uses the false name at the time when the officer is in the process of serving the warrant. I think the language is pretty clear. It's just the same as if an individual is stopped for a traffic site or stopped for a traffic violation. Just because someone gives the wrong name or false name at the time that they are first contacted, that in itself does not equate into false information to a police officer. It's at the point when the officer intends to give the citation. So there's that second step, and that's exactly my belief of how it is written, and that was my intent. It's basically everyone's going to have to know. The defense that the individual would have is that he or she did not know that they were in the process of having the warrant served upon them. And what you will see, I think, in more common situations, and Brad may be able to elaborate on it from his perspective of what he's seen coming through his office, is that you have someone that may give a false information and say a false name, but the officer runs it and they come up with a pretty good hit of it being maybe someone else, and then they approach them and say, and they would basically play it out in the sense of, I don't believe you're telling me the truth. I've got a person who's wanted by, you know, whatever name or with a different date of birth, and then basically giving them that opportunity to come clean. If they fail to do so, at that point, I would say that they would be subject to being charged with that crime.
And again, I mean, I recognize the distinction. I think where the officer is targeting somebody that they've got a warrant for the purpose of, you know, issuing that warrant for arrest, and the person lies to them about who they are, in an effort to deceive the officer so they're not issued the warrant, I completely agree that that ought to be, that failure to give accurate information ought to be a chargeable offense. I think it is a different situation where an officer asks, as they're allowed to do, an individual who's there, they've, you know, met on the street and they have an interest in inquiring who this person might be, but they don't have a known warrant. They then learn that there's a warrant, and they approach the person at that point and ask them. That's a different situation, and I, obviously you can see where, as you read this, it's possible that someone could construe that situation also to fall within potentially the language of this bill and say that they had given false information relative to the issuance of the warrant. Mr. Berry, do you want to...
Mr. Chair, I had the and members of the committee, I talked with Ms. Skye about this actually before we started. We were talking about the breadth or what this bill might cover. If I can maybe dodge your question a little bit and then come back to it, I think what we're getting into is an issue related to the burden of proof. I think the state, on proving this offense, would have to show that, one, the false information was given knowingly to avoid the service of the warrant. And what happens, getting back now more to your question, where you have the circumstance of what the law calls a mere conversation between an officer and an individual on the street, or perhaps a passenger in a vehicle, and ask them for their identity, the person may say, I'm Max Williams. And then they go run, comes back, it doesn't match or whatever, and they come back and inquire further. But with that all by itself, let's assume a warrant pops up, and with magic as it is today in the cars, you get the picture, you see who it is, and you go hook them up. State would then have to still prove that they knowingly gave the false information to avoid the service of the warrant. And if you can't show that, for example, the guy just didn't want to say because he'd been drinking and he's on probation and not supposed to drink, state may not be able to prove it. But what does happen on occasion when they come back and say, well, isn't it true you're Brad Berry? And I say, oh, yeah, yes, I am. Why'd you lie to me? Because I knew I had a warrant out for my arrest. I think then that, in fact, you would have proof to a jury that the person gave the false information to avoid service of a warrant. That's why they didn't tell you who they were. And as I read this bill, I thought it would cover that circumstance. It seems to me, though, that it's a matter of proof, and being able to prove that, in fact, the false information was given for a particular purpose.
Okay. Representative Shetterman.
Well, thanks. The comment is also, I think, a matter of parsing the language here. Because if you look at it, we're adding the first part, a person commits the crime of giving false information to a peace officer for issuance or service of a citation or a warrant. But then if you follow that through on line 8, starting on line 7, where you've given this false information for the purpose of the officer's issuing or serving, so that's either issuing or serving a citation, or, the new language, serving a warrant. So I guess my question is, what is exactly serving a warrant? Because we're not talking about issuance of a warrant, whatever that is, but this is service of a warrant that comes under here. And so if you've got that conversation and you say, are you Max Williams? And he says, you kidding? I'm Brad Berry. And you go back to the car and you find out that, well, you know, let's say you find out that there's this warrant, whatever the case may be. Now you go back. You've gotten information off the computer that there's a warrant for this person that you believe is who you believe it is. Is that service of a warrant? I mean, what is service of a warrant? You've got information on the computer that says Max Williams has a warrant out for him. He's given you a false name. You know it's Max Williams, and you've gotten the information off the computer that there is a warrant. But now if you go back, is that service of a warrant? Are we under the statute even at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shirley, it would seem to me at the point that you have, I'm going to pick a technical legal term here, probable cause, to believe that you have Max Williams in the car and a warrant for Max Williams, and you return and ask again for the name, that clearly you are doing it for the purposes of service of the warrant. I think the factual scenario you give fits to a T what's here.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can just follow, what you've got, Brad, is you've got information off of a computer that says there is a warrant. You don't have the warrant. That's what gets back to my point. What is exactly service of a warrant? You have information off a warrant that says there's a warrant out for this person, but you're not serving it. You're arresting based on probable cause from what you see off the computer, but you don't have anything with you. What is service of a warrant in that circumstance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I believe that the service of the warrant, as it's intended here, it would be affecting the arrest on the warrant. The officer effectively does that. I did not read this, and Representative Brzezinski may have intended something different, but I don't think it was technically meant that the paper warrant served at the jail once you're in custody was service. That's not how I read it.
And that's not was not my intent, as well as it was not my intent to have an individual who's just basically in mere conversation with an officer to be held accountable based on that conversation that may have occurred. There's got to be something that triggers to the officer that there is a valid warrant active at that point in time to Lane.
Yeah.
No.
No. You want to finish your comments?
Yes. And as Brad has mentioned, I mean, if you have an individual who basically admits to the officer, and it does happen, I've read too many reports where an individual says, when the officer says, "I believe you have given me a false name. Isn't your name John Brown?" And they say yes, and they ask, "Why did you give that to me?" Because I know I have a warrant out, that then they actually were giving the John Brown as the first name wrong at that point, because they had actual knowledge that there was a warrant for their arrest, and they should and would be captured under this under the provisions regarding the actual service of the warrant. I guess it's a term of art that I have been relying on, based as a prosecutor, that the officer is going to validate that the warrant is still active through dispatch. Once that is known, then he or she is going to have the probable cause that that individual is in fact does in fact have a warrant for service, and that they would in fact be technically under, at that point, under the jurisdiction for being served the warrant. Now, if the committee thinks that the term of art of service of the warrant is inappropriate, you could always change it to the point of arresting upon the probable cause of the warrant. But I guess I did not see that as an issue, but maybe
Representative Ackerman had a question, then Representative Barker.
I just have another hypothetical. In a search warrant situation, it's my experience that most search warrants are not directed against a person, but are directed to a particular premises. Mm-hmm. So what happens in a situation where the officer is serving a search warrant, gains entry to the premises, interrogates people therein, and they give false names? They're not named in the search warrant as they would be in a warrant of arrest or a citation. Do we have a violation?
No, I'd say not.
Yeah. Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I would say not, with a caveat, that if the individual who is found within the house, say, of a drug search warrant, you're looking for drugs, and you come there and it's not uncommon, you'll have several people in the house. The officer, of course, is identifying their, in part, witnesses to crimes, so they would identify them. If the person identified themselves as Brad Berry and, in fact, were Lane Chetterly, and did so to avoid service of an outstanding warrant, then I think this law may in fact arise. But again, I see that as a problem of proof from the prosecution standpoint, that likely would be, that proof would be made by subsequent statements to the individual. Yeah, but you are right, it's not uncommon that folks will lie about who they are when found inside a drug house, for example, on a search warrant, and most of the time they don't have outstanding warrants, they just don't want to be identified as appropriately identified as being in the drug house.
But what's wrong with the argument in your hypothetical that when the person gives a false name, you have probable cause to arrest, there's never going to be the opportunity for an arrest warrant to issue, so it seems to me your scenario that the person is avoiding an arrest warrant by using a false name is not material.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
It's a previous warrant. Outstanding warrant.
Oh, yeah, previous
outstanding warrant.
An outstanding warrant,
yeah,
correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's right. I understand that now. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say my experience in dealing primarily with the citation thing, when the question came up of who somebody really was, you'd say, look, if they issue a citation, you have to tell me your true name or you'll be in violation. It's against the law to give a false name. Once I'm telling you, I'm going to arrest you and issue the citation. So you have to take those extra steps. And those are commonly taken. And really, we consider a warrant served when we arrested somebody. The way it worked in Portland, I'd have to call on a different channel, call records, say, I have Lane Chetterly. Is there a warrant? Is that warrant still valid? They'd actually go pull the physical warrant and say, yes, we have it. And then you go downtown. Otherwise, you're let loose when they check and say, that's already been taken care of or something.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherry.
I'll bet if we were parsing that wouldn't be an arrest under a warrant. That'd be arrest based on probable cause, on the knowledge that there is an outstanding warrant. I don't think that would technically be an arrest on a warrant, on service of a warrant. I'm guessing. I think this language may not get you exactly where you want to go.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask just another hypothetical, and maybe I'm not reading it right, and it may lie in line 8 in the existing language of the law, which says serving the person. Because maybe the person matches up to the person that's referenced in the second word in the section. But if you've got somebody outside the house and you pull up and you say, we're looking for Bill Smith to serve him a warrant, is that Bill Smith in there through the window? And the guy says, it's not. And in fact, it is Bill Smith. Is the person who's now just misled the officer as to the identity of Bill Smith come in violation of this statute?
Not of this statute.
Giving false information to a peace officer for issuance of servants of a citation or a warrant if the person knowingly uses or gives false or fictitious name, so let's say they said it's John Smith, blah, 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 for the purpose of the officers issuing or serving the person a citation under authority. So are the two persons absolutely connected? So it can't be another person that's falling in this trap?
Mr. Chair, from my practice since 1987 doing prosecution work, I've never seen a third party being cited under giving false information to a peace officer as it pertains to another individual.
Mr. Chair?
Representative,
again, following your question, I think it's because you've got person in both places there. I think there's, it gets back to maybe the passive again here, where, in fact, it's an interesting distinction because there's issuing or serving the person a citation, and if you go on to the language, or serving a warrant, that's really, I guess, anybody who gets between the police officer and the service of the warrant. So that new language does seem to be broader in terms of who would be potentially subject to prosecution of this without the language or serving the person a warrant to match up with the phraseology of the citation language.
I don't think you've got, the sense I get is I don't think you've got a problem fundamentally with what we're trying to accomplish here, with the willingness to allow for a Class A misdemeanor charge against a person who is giving false information when there is a warrant attempting to be, you know, served on the person, however we want to define that service of the warrant issue. I don't think that you've got a problem here. I think we're hung up a little bit on whether or not the language gets us to the spot that the committee would be willing to go and avoids the arguments, you know, are going to be raised the first time you guys try to use this if we don't maybe tighten it up. So what I think I'd like to do, Representative Przanski, is have you work with counsel and Mr. Berry. Certainly, Kelly, I think you can, you know, be in on that discussion and give your thoughts as well and see if we can come up with some amendments that sort of make this focused where we want it to focus without making it so broad that we're going to run into trouble down the road. Is that reasonable to you, Brad?
It certainly is, Mr. Chair.
Floyd, that's okay?
Absolutely fair.
And Kelly, you'll work with these guys?
Certainly.
I recognize that you still may want to oppose the bill after we make the amendments to it, and I'm not asking you to necessarily change your position, but I think you might as well be part of the discussion of the amendment drafting to try to narrow it the way we're talking about.
Perhaps, can I make one more point?
Sure.
Chair Williams, I think that Representative Barker best described my concern with the bill. And when he talks about how an officer notifies a person that I am issuing you a citation, you need to give me a true name, and that's true. We see that in police reports. And that person knows they're giving their name for purposes of issuance of a citation. The difference is the passenger in the motor vehicle that's pulled over and the officer says, what's your name? That person doesn't know why the officer is asking that question. There could be a number of reasons. I think that, at least from my conversations with Mr. Berry, that he would like there to be a presumption that the person knows this officer is asking my name for purposes of serving a warrant if I have one. And so I don't see it as a problem of proof. I see it as a problem of, is that person guilty of the crime? Are we going to assume as a matter of law that they know that that question is being asked for purposes of issuance of a warrant? Or is it more of a situation like Representative Barker's talking about where the officer's coming back and saying, I have a warrant for so-and-so, or I think you're so-and-so who has a warrant, and then that person knows that they're giving a false information for purposes of service of a warrant. And that right there is the distinction that we have a problem with.
Okay.
And just one more thing, if I may.
Sure.
As long as we'll be looking at this again. I do want to make sure now, the statutes that are referred to on line 9, 133.110 and 133.120 are both arrest warrant statutes. 133.545 is the search warrant statute. And I guess my question, and maybe this gets back to what Representative Ackerman was asking, but when you're serving a search warrant on a property, is there anything right now that obligates somebody on the premises to give their name, address, and birth date to the officer that's executing the warrant? Because this criminalizes that. If there's no obligation now, all of a sudden we're creating it and criminalizing it for the purpose of executing a search warrant.
Yeah.
my intention in bringing this forward was nothing to deal with search warrants.
Okay, what's in there?
I hear what you're saying. And that's something that we can look at.
Okay.
But my intention was basically where an individual has an active arrest warrant, and I've actually written in a potential change of language where it would be an arrest warrant in the two places in the bill, and then that would also take care of that other one. I did not notice or realize that a general search warrant was, let's say, encompassed mm-hmm. in that new language.
Council.
Chair, members of the committee, I've just been scribbling some notes here and probably would like some guidance, but I've written down here would be a person commits the crime of giving false information to a police officer for services or warrant upon the person, if the person knowingly, et cetera, gives information. So it would be upon the person. And add something in there that the person knows there's a warrant outstanding, or knows or should have known. I'm just trying to get some kind of guidance to where to go.
I've got something else.
Yeah, why don't you guys work it out? I'm happy to. I think there's a general sense that the committee's interested in trying to address the issue so we can deal with people who are knowingly giving false names without any consequences. And I'm happy to involve Legislative Counsel's office in some drafting as well and see what we can do. And then we'll come back to the committee. But it's a prime example of. Even small bills seem to we can complicate almost anything, Brad. So, all right, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 2725.
Thank you.
And we're no respecter of persons. We even do it to our own members.
Yeah,
all of the committee.
Rodney Degner, Bill.
Okay.
It's getting warm.
Our next bill is House Bill 2727. I'll open a public hearing. I don't have anybody signed up. Is this yours too,
the
Floyd?
Next two are, yes.
Okay, all right, good. Just wanted to see. I didn't have anybody else signed up on this one.
Mr. Chair, Floyd Przanski, House District 8, State Representative. House Bill 2727 is being brought to you as what I'm calling a house cleaning measure, no pun intended, to a statute that went into effect on its passage this last session, 2001. At that time, the body determined that they wanted to allow or let's say permit an individual to be cited for criminal trespass in the first degree if they entered property that had been posted by either the health department or one of their designees or a law enforcement agency regarding that had been posted for not being fit for use under the health statutes. Specifically, what this deals with is health, meth labs that have been found on properties. What we have found in one of the two jurisdictions that I work in as a prosecutor is that we have had individuals who are owner occupants of the property who are the actual defendants in a meth lab case who have re-entered the property. And the concern law enforcement has on this re-entry is they have no knowledge under the current language of the statute. An owner of the property under the current statute is allowed to enter or remain on the premises for the purpose of inspecting or decontaminating the premises or for other lawful means in the sense of removing items from the premises. And then there's another qualifier for that. All we're asking for is another requirement that before the owner of that property enters the property, that they give notice by notifying a law enforcement agency that has jurisdiction over the premises that they do intend to enter the property. We believe this is would serve two purposes. One, that it will give law enforcement notice that an individual is actually entering the property, and also to make certain that there's no other concerns that law enforcement may have with someone entering the property that they could actually go out to the property while they're there. It could be that they may have still designated it as somewhat of a crime scene and are concerned that someone may be tampering with items that should not be removed or tampered with, and at the same time the health issues that could still be present. That's the purpose for the amendment.
Okay. Are there questions for Representative Przanski, Representative Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Representative, what kind of exposure would this potentially present to law enforcement?
what I mean by that, what kind of legal exposure, so that if they've been notified by a property owner that the owner is going to go into a contaminated property, the owner then turns around and says, well, the police let me in there and I got this lung cancer or whatever because I was allowed back into a contaminated property, and so I'm going to sue the law enforcement agency, or I'm going to sue the city or the county or whatever the case may be. Is there, do you see any kind of potential exposure there? Or am I barking up the wrong tree?
Well, I think anyone could, Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I guess anyone could raise a claim against an entity or an individual for allowing them. Currently, the property to be affected by this statute or any property that has been designated as unfit for use is required to be posted. And in this particular case, the administrative rules that control the posting requires postings at every door to the property. And so now whether or not an individual would be successful in bringing a claim against a law enforcement agency or the entity, the governmental body that they work for or as part of, I can't answer that for you. But it seemed to me that the notices in of itself as the posting is basically going to notify these individuals that they're probably entering at their own risk, and whether they could transfer that risk to the governmental body, I can't answer that.
Thank you.
Further questions?
I guess I'll ask a quick one, if I may.
Yeah, Representative Barker, then Representative.
So what you're really intending to do here is prevent somebody from going in there to potentially destroy evidence. So they have to come tell the police, that the police have the opportunity to say, you can't go in there yet, that's still a crime scene, we have it locked down until we can finish our search or whatever they haven't finished. Is that what this is aiming at? It's mainly so that somebody won't go in there and say, well, I own the property, I thought I could go back in.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, is there any time limit on this? Because I'm sure in some cases the landlord is eager to get back in and start the process of decontaminating and getting it back into function. Is there any way of limiting the time needed to protect the evidence and then get this back into the market?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the intent of this bill is not to prolong the time before an individual can enter the property to do the decontamination. And the reality is that most of the a number of individuals who are affected by a meth lab probably are not owner occupants of the premises. They are probably going to be notified by the departments that are involved in the actual criminal activity that their property has been used illegally, and they're going to be getting notices. There's nothing in the intent of the amendment to this to prohibit the individual from going through there. As Representative Barker asked, is the intent, that is part of the intent, is if there is actually an active crime scene still going forward. We also believe that in the particular case that I'm most familiar with, since this is just a very recent statute, it has not been used too often, to my knowledge, at least in Lane County, is that there is a concern that an individual may be coming onto the property for other reasons than for the purposes that are set there. And if it is, and if the owner is the occupant who has been cited, law enforcement would at least have the opportunity to, one, know that they're entering the property, and two, if they choose to actually go out to the location while the individual may be there. I mean, they still have all the other obligations and duties to everyone's health and safety to post the property.
Okay.
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, Representative, I'm looking at line 14, the bold-faced language. Is that standing alone as a separate defense for this offense? As I look at new B and C, we have the word and between B and C. Should A be standing alone with a disjunctive or at the end of line 415?
Yeah.
Or do you have to meet all three qualifications to stay there? I don't think that's the intention.
No, the intention is that any owner be required to notify the department that has jurisdiction over the property prior to entering.
and then the other two were working together simultaneously because the original statute said they could enter the property for the purpose of inspecting or decontaminating or removing items, lawfully removing items from the premises, and that the owner has not been arrested for or charged with. So there, even if you are the owner, if you have been charged with the an offense arising out of the premises being determined to be not fit for use, you would not be able to enter the property for the purposes of inspection or decontamination because you are prohibited because you are the actual participant has been charged or convicted. And so those two have to work together. We just felt that the need of the owner besides those individuals, any owner would be required, that's I guess the best way I should say it, should be required to notify the agency prior to entering the premises.
I don't know that I understand. I guess what I'm saying, does new A trump B and C? Is it standing alone as a separate independent ground to provide a privilege or a defense to this? Or if a person is going to be on the premises, he has to meet A, B, and C?
They would need to meet A, B, and C to get the defense. Because B and C were the, as it's line 16 and 18, are the current defense that's available. And to meet that defense, they still would have to give notice to the department.
Okay.
Anything else? Mark, City of Portland has a meth property bill, and I'm trying to recall exactly what it does. Could you come up and just refresh my recollection? I know we don't have it up for hearing today. I think it's scheduled, isn't it?
I don't, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. We have been working with Representative Dingfelder on a bill that would permit local governments to notify neighbors of a contaminated property that there is a contaminated property in their neighborhood because, as the members of the committee know, these are rather dangerous sites. City of Portland actually had requested this legislation back in 2001. The committee, as you know, passed this into law. And I agree with Representative Przanski's analysis that A, B, and C would have to be met in order for somebody to enter a property. If that person who requests to enter the property has been arrested, charged, or convicted of a criminal offense that contributed to the determination, I believe that, never mind that last statement. We believe A, B, and C would have to work all together.
Okay. And you supported essentially this bill last session.
Was introduced at the request of the City of Portland, and the problem was that we were posting and are posting premises. Oftentimes, though, people who have been caught producing meth in these properties will re-enter those properties, simply rip down the signs, re-enter, and we had absolutely no enforcement tool to remove them from those properties. As a result, we introduced this legislation so that we had some enforcement mechanism to remove them.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2727. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2727.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Parker.
I'd like to move House Bill 2727 to the floor with a due pass.
I'll stay there.
Recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation. Representative Parker moves it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Hearing none. Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Parker?
Aye.
Cromwell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Lubansky?
Aye.
Saturday?
Aye.
And Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2727 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Prozanski to carry. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2729.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. Flair Prozanski, House District 8, State Representative. House Bill 2729 is coming to you at the request of Lane County District Attorney's Office. Kent Mortimore, who is the Chief Deputy, and I are pretty close friends and had worked together. He brought to my attention that prior to session, there had been a determination by the Court Administrator's Office that they were going to now require individuals who were victims of crime to have their addresses, names and addresses on the judgments when there was a compensatory or a restitution, compensatory fine or restitution ordered in the case. The concern that we have is that these individuals that are victims should not be required to actually give their addresses or names, or I should say addresses particularly, in a public record because of their concern for their safety. It's my understanding that after there was some discussion, I actually spoke with the court administrator out of Lane County, Dave Factor, and it was my understanding that they felt that maybe they could interpret the statute differently where they would not need to be requesting the victim's address. When you look at the language that's affected on this bill, it's on page 2, basically lines 12 through 16. What we are attempting to do is make it very clear and explicit that an individual who is a victim is not required to provide this information. They choose not to. The current language says that basically the name and address of a person whom the court should disburse payments to should be on the judgment. Then it says this paragraph does not require the name and address of a victim, comma, but may include other persons designated by the victim who will pass the restitution or fine on to the victim without requiring the victim's name and address to be of the record. The concern for the district attorney's office and my concern is what if a victim does not have or chooses not to use an alternative name or address of a friend, family member, or whoever? Would they be obligated to have their own listed? We feel that the change will make it very explicit that as our state has looked to protect victims' rights, that they would not be required to provide an address specifically on the a judgment that would be a public record for all to see.
Questions for Representative Prozanski? Are you worried at all, Representative, that the deletion of the language that sort of was clarifying language that says it doesn't have to be the victim, but it can be the victim's designee, is being deleted? I mean, it does say, if restitution or compensatory fine is ordered, the name and address of the person to whom the court should distribute payments, unless the victim requests the information remain confidential. So it's implied that that the person could be someone other than the victim. The previous language of the statute, as you pointed out, made a clarifying statement that the paragraph does not require the name and address of the victim, but may include other persons designated by the victim who will pass the restitution. So, I mean, it had some clarifying language that described that it didn't have to be the victim. I'm just wondering if you're concerned about the deletion of that language at all.
I've ran this past both the District Attorney's Office in Lane County as well as the state or the court administrator for Lane County. They were fine with the language, but I have no opposition to retaining the language that's there so long as the boldface is included. The concern is that at some point, and I'm not sure at what level, someone determined that they were going to require the victim's address, and we do not want to see that interpretation to go forward in the future.
Right. Okay. Mr. Swank has signed up for this bill, if you'd come forward.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for the State Court Administrator's Office. I find myself in a deja vu position. You look at OS-137-071, you're looking at a piece of legislation that was an OJT piece of legislation in either 89 or 91, I forget which, in which I lobbied very hard to get passed. I don't I find the representation of Mr. Factor's position very interesting. The language that you are talking about that's being deleted was put in specifically for the purpose, and I think it actually does say that you don't have to have the victim's name, you don't have to have the victim's address, and that's what it says. What we need, as the chair knows, the right to restitution arises, or the right to a disbursement of restitution arises by being named in the judgment. Whoever is named gets the right to the disbursement of restitution. If nobody is named in the judgment, then nobody has the right to restitution. That's just the legal consequence of the judgment, is that if it's not included in the document, then you don't have the right. So for the legal right for disbursement of restitution to arise, somebody has to be named. We don't care who's named. When we worked out the language in 89 or 91, we said, you know, name the DA for all you want. Name the sheriff. Name the victim's rights people. Because when you put that person in the judgment, that's to whom we are going to give the restitution. The other thing that we need is a practical matter, not as a legal matter, but as a practical matter for us to do our job, is an address. All the other addresses in judgments tell clerks where to give something. If there's no address, we'll just hang on to the money for 3 years, and then at the end of the 3 years, turn it over to the land board and let somebody go there and pick it up. Because unless we get the address to put into the computer to disperse with that, says where we're going to send the check, we're going to cut it to this person's name, and we're going to send it to this address. And if we don't have that information, then the money just sits with us. Those things are necessary for us to do our job. We think the current language makes it clear that it doesn't have to be the victim. I mean, it says, does not require the name and address of the victim. And we don't care who they name. And we don't care what address they give us. But whatever goes in the judgment, we need those two things for us to do our job and not just hold on to the money. Whatever name they give us, that's who's going to get the check, and they're going to get it the address they give it to us. And as importantly, for instance, if Chair Williams was damaged, you're getting used as a lot of examples today, was damaged in a crime and wanted restitution, but under current law didn't want his name or address in the judgment. Fine with us. So he gives Mr. Taylor, who has Mr. Joseph's name in front of him, almost custom. He gives Mr. Taylor's name and address as the person who gets the check and money. We write the check and money to Mr. Taylor's address and his name. Mr. Williams, Chair Williams, does not have a right to come into the court and say, well, now I want you to send that to another address, because Mr. Taylor is named in the judgment. It would have to either be Mr. Taylor to come in and change the disbursement, and that would be true if Representative Williams wanted the money to go to his mother rather than to him, wanted to make an assignment. Mr. Williams wouldn't have the right to make that assignment on his own. Mr. Taylor would, because Mr. Taylor is the person named in the judgment with the right to the disbursement. So it's out of the paper that the right arises. And as it reads, it appears to say that the victim could say that we don't want to put a name, any name or address, in the judgment. And if that happened, nobody would get the money.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherwin.
Well, except Brad, line 11 requires the identity of the judgment. I'm sorry, line 10, identity of the judgment creditor. That's mm-hmm. still there. That tells you who's entitled to be paid.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, unfortunately in criminal judgments it does not. The judgment creditor in a criminal judgment is the state. We collect the judgments. We are the judgment creditor. And we make a disbursement to those people who are named as having a right to disbursement.
Sure. Additional questions? Council Taylor.
Chairman of the committee, Mr. Swank, when I read the language that was being removed, I couldn't figure out what the problem was. Now I think I see what the problem is. But let's assume you have a victim who is concerned that by putting their name and address in the judgment for restitution, which is now a public document, the perpetrator, the person who victimized them, could now find them. What's the practical solution to this?
Chair Williams, Mr. Taylor, it is sort of a conundrum. I mean, we do have a requirement that judgments be public in Oregon, that justice be rendered openly and without purchase, so judgments are public. The best solution we could come to in 89 was the solution that the language that you thought of, and we worked out it with legislative counsel's office and with victims groups at the time to say that you could name, we don't care who you name, it should be somebody you trust because they're the person who gets the right, but for the right to attach to anybody, somebody has to be named.
Counsel.
Chair members of the committee, so I assume that if the victim goes and says, I don't want my name in there,
mm-hmm.
you ask for an alternative name, and if they say, I'm new in town, I don't know anyone, I just got off the bus, then you insist that they give their name and address?
Well, Chair Williams, Bill Taylor, we actually don't mostly, or in a number of counties, about half the counties, judgments are currently written by the district attorneys. It's about a third of the counties. About a third of the counties, the court makes arrangements for criminal judgments, and in about a third of the counties, we currently have a uniform criminal judgment that we're rolling out that's done by computer. And somebody at some point is going to say to the victim, and it's general information we derive from the district attorney, you know, if you want this right to attach to somebody, we need a name and an address. We pretty much don't care whose name and address it is, but that's who's going to get the check, and that's the address it's going to go to. So it's not the only thing that we are insistent on is that there be something we can put in there, or we can't do our job, and the right doesn't attach. And it is a problem for people who come in and don't know anybody. In some counties, victims' assistance programs handle the payments, and we're paying because. And I know that some district attorneys have lost funding for their victims' assistance programs, which makes it harder in some areas. But in some counties, it's the victims' assistance program. They keep the records. They keep them confidential. We just send the money to them. In some counties, it could be the sheriff's department that handles them or the district attorney's office themselves that handle the payments. And we don't care.
Representative Pisanski, then Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I think what it may be best on this one, after we go through the questions, is I'd ask maybe to give myself an opportunity to work with Ms. Swank, as well as Council Taylor. I'd like to call back down to Lane County District Attorney's Office. I think there's a fix here, using more than likely the District Attorney's Office as a clearinghouse, since they more than likely would still have contact and they would already have the information. But before I volunteer that, I think I need to one run at Lane County and probably even ODAA.
Yeah, I think the association ought to weigh in on that, but I think that's a representative or Council Taylor was signaling a similar potential suggestion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a reasonable solution, but just one question. If the name of the judgment doesn't have to be within the state, it could be anywhere, which would answer Mr. the Council's question. It seemed to me that if a person didn't live here very long, they could ship it to California or New York.
Right. Absolutely.
And for, it can be a post office box, it can be a mailbox address, anything like that.
Yeah, but it probably can't be just under some rock someplace, some real address. But, right. But yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Glad you got back for this, Representative McPherson.
It's thrilling.
Yeah. Okay, good. We're going to go ahead and close then the public hearing on House Bill 2729. Representative McPherson, we only had one vote that you missed, which was on House Bill 2784. With the committee's permission, I'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2784 with suspension of the rules to allow Representative McPherson an opportunity to vote on that bill. Any objection? Hearing none, Representative McPherson, how do you vote on House Bill 2784?
I vote aye on House Bill 2784.
The rest of us voted no, so we appreciate it. No, we all voted aye.
It was minority report.
I was tempted. I thought maybe outside of protocol to ask how the rest of the House voted.
Yeah.
I took a wire on it.
There's a second one.
There is. I'm sorry. No, he was here for that one.
I was. Chance on that one.
So Representative McPherson votes aye on House Bill 2784. And with that committee, we're adjourned for the rest of the day. And Representative Brzezinski, you'll work with the folks on these other bills.